Lecture 14, Flinders Petrie and the Small Artifact.
One of the best ways to look at the history of the discovery of the early civilizations is to look at it through the prism of a single archaeologist's career. This lecture does just that. We look at the exciting career of the British archaeologist Flinders Petrie, arguably the greatest Egyptologist of his day. Petrie was a controversial figure, a flamboyant figure, and a teacher of innumerable generations of later Egyptologists. We begin with his early career when he surveyed the pyramids of Giza in Egypt and started annual excavations which were remarkable for his concern with small, insignificant objects, a concern learnt from the German example in Greece. The second part of this lecture describes some of Petrie's most important discoveries, among them the Mycenaean artifacts at Gureb and other well-dated Nile sites, and the Elamana cuneiform tablets from the heretic pharaoh Akhenaten's capital, a diplomatic archive of the utmost importance. We describe how Petrie used the Gureb potsherds to date archaeological sites from Egypt, far from Egypt, the cross-dating method which is still used today. Finally, we accompany Petrie to the small town of Nagada in Upper Egypt, where he developed a new method for dating desert graves which dated to before the pharaohs, a system called sequence dating, which is still used by archaeologists, albeit in a modified form, today. This is an interesting point in this lecture course too, historically, because I actually met an elderly archaeologist, Mortimer Wheeler, who we'll talk about much later in the course, who knew Flinders Petrie and talked to him on his deathbed. So for the first time, we're beginning to get links, which you might call grandfather links, right back to historical figures. So we really are coming into the modern era. Flinders Petrie was one of the last self-taught archaeologists. He was an ardent field worker who was happiest in the field and raised the science of Egyptology to new heights, as well as developing highly effective methods for dating newly discovered civilizations like the Mycenaeans and the Minoans, who we'll talk about in the next lecture, far from the Nile. He also trained generations of students, among them Howard Carter of Tutankhamun fame, a discovery we'll talk about later, and Leonard Woolley, who excavated biblical Ur of the Chaldees, which also we will talk about later. What was extraordinary about Petrie was that he had almost no formal schooling whatsoever. There he'd probably be described as someone who had learning disabilities. But he developed a passion for archaeology in his teens. He was born into a middle-class family, and his father had a passion for mapping and surveying. In 1872, and remember this was a time when archaeology was still largely an amateur pursuit and methods were very casual, he and his father surveyed the stone circles at Stonehenge in southern England. Now today, you cannot get among the stones. You have to walk round an asphalt path around the perimeter. You need a special permit to go into the interior of the site. In Petrie's day, it wasn't even a fence. You just walked in. And he and his father spent several weeks making an accurate survey of the stone circles. In 1880, he cast his eye to Egypt. Originally, his father was going to go with him, but declined. So he went by himself. And in 1880, he surveyed the pyramids of Giza with unheard-of accuracy, a process that took him more than a year. This was a survey unimaginably accurate by earlier standards. The pyramids, of course, had been known ever since they were built. They were familiar archaeological monuments. And much speculation surrounded them. There were a whole category of people who were often called pyramidiots, who assumed that the pyramids were complicated astronomical observatories, that they had been built as ancient computers. The arguments go on and on. And Petrie said, this is nonsense. I'm just going to survey these really accurately. And he laughed at people who tried to prove that dimensions of the pyramids coincided with their own theories about measurement units and would actually chip away at the stones to try and make them fit. He was plagued with tourists. So he resorted to wandering around clothed only in his red underwear. And my dear, the scandal! He wasn't respectable. But then Flinders Petrie, in the moralistic Victorian environment of the day, was an outsider anyhow. He wasn't of the upper classes. He wasn't college educated. He was a working archaeologist. But he was a man of extraordinary intelligence and brilliance, and a man of great perception. He observed, as he surveyed the pyramids, the extremely crude methods used by Mariette and others, the wave of destruction which had descended upon the Nile. Nothing, he said, seems to be done with any uniform and regular plan. Work is begun and left unfinished. No regard is paid to future requirements of exploration. In one of his most memorable expressions, he said, it is sickening to see the rate at which everything is being destroyed and little regard paid to preservation. Here is the conscience coming out, the conscience which is slowly beginning to emerge from eras of treasure hunting. Petrie also, at this very early stage in his career, realized the critical importance of pot fragments and other small objects. From survey, he turned to excavation. And between 1883 and 1887, he excavated a late Egyptian settlement, the Greek-Egyptian city of Naukratis, and then the city of Tanis in the flat delta of Lower Egypt. Now, Naukratis and Tanis were trading cities, so you got objects from all over the place. Petrie paid particular attention to a number of things. One of them were papyri. Papyri are mines of information. He also paid attention to small finds like potsherds, and he acquired these somewhat unconventionally by the simple expedient of paying his workers for important finds. His logic was simple. If they didn't sell it to him, they would sell it to the dealers. And the dealers were hovering always at the fringes of any scientific excavation. At this point, he was working for the Egypt Exploration Fund, which was led by that formidable lady we met in the last lecture, Amelia Edwards, who campaigned for the rest of her life for Egyptology. And when she died, and she was not a rich woman, left money to endow a professorship at the University of London for Petrie. But that lay in the future, and Petrie, who was difficult, he could be quarrelsome, quarreled with the Egyptian Exploration Society. He had already a reputation as a man who published promptly. He insisted that the results of one season were published before the next one began, a remarkable departure for archaeologists, and something that today's archaeologists should remember. It's very sexy to go digging. It's not nearly as sexy as to sit in a lab for a year and write up your results. It's dull. Besides, people don't give money for it. So the tendency is always to dig and not write up, which is a scandal of modern archaeology. Petrie didn't do that. He wrote up. He wrote up hastily, but he wrote it up. And after 1887, he became a freelance excavator, financing his excavations by selling artifacts to museums. Now, he did this under reasonably controlled circumstances, not controlled by today's standards, and many of them were duplicates. He also had to deal with the Egyptian authorities, but policies were somewhat liberal because Egypt at that point was basically under European colonial rule. And what he did was to develop into a pattern where he spent the cooler winters in Egypt excavating, often accepting young archaeologists or potential archaeologists as trainees who worked under his supervision. Petrie's technique was to get some young person, like Howard Carter, Tutankhamun discoverer, give them a bit of site to work on, watch them a while, and then let them off on their own. He was of the old-fashioned British training system of sink or swim, which, if I may say so as an Englishman or a former Englishman, is a method that works, provided the stakes are not too high. These young archaeologists soon learnt the vital importance of small artifacts, but they also learnt that Flinders Petrie was a skinflint. Living conditions in his camps were notoriously arduous. The food was appalling and often spoiled. You slept on a rough camp bed with mummies and other finds under your couch. But you learnt archaeology. Petrie continued to make superb discoveries. In the Delta, he found a cemetery of Roman Egyptian burials of the period AD 100 to 250, late, when it was a Roman province, at a place called Harawa, in the Fayum Depression west of the Nile, which, as we will see in a future lecture, became famous for early agriculture. What was interesting about these mummies, and Egyptologists on the whole haven't been that interested in Roman Egyptians, was that these mummies had, over the faces, vivid, lifelike portraits of the deceased. This was a way of commemorating them, and if you go to the British Museum, you can see some of these. You see, there was an interesting thing about Flinders Petrie. He wasn't just interested in the Valley of Kings, or Karnak, or Luxor, or the Serapeum. He was as much interested in unspectacular sites as he was in the prominent and sensational. And this preoccupation with the commonplace was a real turning point in archaeology, unconscious, little recognized at the time. But today it's safe to say that more archaeologists work on the commonplace than on the spectacular. Why? Because we've realized very often that the heart of many civilizations lies in the people who were part of it, not just in the rulers. An extraordinary work, for example, is being done on ancient Egyptian women, on workers of different specializations and so on, where the archaeologists concerned work far from the limelight on extraordinary, fascinating, detailed detective work. In a way, Petrie was the ancestor of these people, because one of the things he was very interested in was recording. And for example, he excavated a town known as El Cajun. It's a workers' town, not a royal palace, not a necropolis, but a workers' town dating to the reign of the pharaoh Senusret II, who reigned from 1890 to 1878 BC. This, he found, was a highly organized community. It dates to the Middle Kingdom of Egyptian civilization, when the pharaohs attempted to organize society rather thoroughly and bureaucracy flourished. And he excavated this town with such thoroughness that we discovered not only many details of the architecture of the small houses and the bigger houses with courtyards, but also from the inscriptions and the papyri a great deal about individuals there. Much of this work has come since Petrie's day. But, for example, we know that many of the officials in this place were very careful to maintain roots with their villages in the countryside from which they had originally come. And there is this dynamic between the town and the countryside, which in a way bonded Egypt together. Petrie was one of the first people, in fact the first person, to excavate a real workers' settlement with remarkable results. From there, he moved to another settlement, a place called Gurab, a new kingdom town of the 18th dynasty. That's when Egypt was at the height of its imperial power. This dynasty lasted from 1750 to 1293 BC. Here, Petrie made one of his most interesting discoveries. Not most spectacular, but interesting. He found, in the excavations, potsherds of brightly painted Mycenaean pottery from Greece, from the other side of the Mediterranean. Now, today, you fly it in an hour. But in those days, it would have been a hazardous sailing ship journey. And anyone who has sailed on the Mediterranean in small boats will tell you that it is a sea of unpredictable winds and surprisingly steep seas. That's quite a journey. particularly if you journey in the summer when the northwest winds in the Aegean are especially strong. And he realized at once, and this was the greatness of Petrie, he looked at a small object and it lived in his hand. He realized, and was the first person to really think about this, that ancient Egyptian civilization hadn't flourished in isolation. He realized that by finding imports of Mycenaean pottery at Gureb and other sites, he could take artifacts from civilizations which weren't dated at all and say, I found it in such and such a dated layer at Gureb, and this potsherd, since it arrived at that site in that level, clearly is of the same period. And for the first time, he dated civilizations far from the Nile. He helped date the Mycenaean civilization, and after 1900, when it was found, the Minoan civilization of Crete. By cross-dating with these potsherds, which had highly distinctive designs on them, and dated Mycenaean civilization, as we saw in a previous lecture, between 1500 and 1200 BC. In other words, for the first time, we had a way of sort of spreading the web of chronology and dating the Mycenaeans found by Heinrich Schliemann so recently, dating even sites further into Europe where the occasional highly distinctive imported Egyptian object was to be found. This cross-dating method, as it's called, is still used today. It's a highly effective, particularly on the fringes of the Eastern Mediterranean world, where trade routes from Mesopotamia and Egypt and the Hittites intersected and stopped at the remote villages which might, for the sake of argument, have bronze or tin to offer. It's still used, to some degree, to date sites in Europe and the Eastern Mediterranean. Here again, you see Petrie founding some of the basic techniques of archaeology. But he did far more than that. He considered it, and this is a very modern sort of statement, he didn't actually deliver it, but he did his best. He considered it a field worker's responsibility to acquire, quote-unquote, all requisite information from a site. This was because he realized that archaeology wasn't finding artifacts, it wasn't finding civilizations. It was part of the tapestry of history. He tried to weave history out of scattered information. A very difficult task, and a task that challenges archaeologists to this day. But perhaps his finest hour in doing this came between 1890 and 1892. It was then that he excavated the site of El Amarna, the abandoned capital of one of Egypt's most notorious pharaohs, the heretic pharaoh Akhenaten, who reigned from 1350 to 1336 BC. Akhenaten, you may remember, was the heretic pharaoh. He was the pharaoh who apparently, and for reasons we have no idea why, became concerned at the power of the sun god Amun and his priesthood, which reigned powerfully from the city of Thebes, or Luxor as we call it now. They owned land. Clearly they had a lot of power. Akhenaten was a religious purist. Today I suppose you would call him evangelical. And he believed in a very pure form of sun worship, which involved worshipping the disk of the sun, Aten. He banned the worship of Amun, closed the temples, seized their lands. This must have been an extremely bold and very troubling political step for a state which was basically extremely conservative in its beliefs and its practices, where the pharaohs ruled by precedent. Not only that, but he moved downstream to El Amarna, where he built a capital, which was only occupied for about 17 years, which from the archaeologist's point of view makes it absolutely priceless, because there was no overburden. and you can clear enormous areas of the town and look at the plan of the city and everything. And Petrie was the first person to dig there. He realized this was a unique chance to study an Egyptian capital. What he did was to excavate large areas. He found, for example, the royal palace and citadel at one end of the town, a ceremonial procession way, and then the sacred and official precinct upstream. But he also discovered not only friezes and paintings and a highly distinctive, very naturalistic art style, he also recovered magnificent wall frescoes and paintings in the palace, and a royal archive of not hieroglyphic documents, but of cuneiform tablets, the diplomatic lingua franca of the Eastern Mediterranean world. Now, this was now a world. At the time when Akhenaten ruled, Egypt was becoming an increasingly powerful imperial power in the Eastern Mediterranean world. At the center of this world wasn't the Nile. It was the eastern Mediterranean shore, which often is called the Levant. And this, as today, was a cockpit of competing interests. To the north, you had the Hittite civilization, which we will talk about in the next lecture. To the east, you had Mycenae and the Minoans. To the south, you had Egypt. I beg your pardon. To the west, you had Mycenae and Minoans. To the south, you had Egypt. To the east, you had Mitanni and Mesopotamia. This archive chronicled the dealings of the pharaohs with this morass of competing interests. It's a fascinating set of documents. It reveals that the pharaohs, the good pharaohs, were masters of diplomacy. Egypt derived its power very largely from its enormous supplies of gold. It used this gold to promise gifts. And there's one tablet which has a prince in the Levant complaining that the pharaoh was going to give him a golden throne, but all he got was a wooden throne covered with gold sheet, and not very good gold sheet at that, I think. The pharaoh was constantly making diplomatic marriages. But, always some strength, no Egyptian princess ever married in a foreign land, but a steady procession of foreign princesses came to Memphis and became part of the king's harem. And there were actually tablets which complain that nobody has heard from such and such a Mesopotamian princess since she married the pharaoh 10 or 15 years ago, and there were tablets saying she's fine. But she probably never slept with him. It was purely a game of diplomatic chess, which the pharaohs often won simply because they were wealthy. And this archive, which he found, really gives you a sense of the backwards and flow of what must have been a very intricate world, but a world where communication was slow by sea or by land, where treachery and little wars and constant maneuvering for power were the meat and drink of a pharaoh's life. Imagine, too, a court where life expectancy was short, where the constant fear of the court was that a pharaoh was going to die suddenly, raising the immediate issue of the succession. It was a court riven with factions, striving for advantage. And with the finding of the Amarna tablets, for the first time, we have a sense of just how complex this world was, which makes the find, and there's an entire literature today, an academic literature on the Amarna tablets, makes this find one of the very most important that Petrie ever made. In 1892, he became the first professor of Egyptology at the University of London. He, I may say, had no university degrees, which he'd earned. But this was a chair established by his friend Amelia Edwards and gave him his first base. And 2 years later, he made one of his most important discoveries. But again, it was a discovery involving extraordinarily unspectacular artifacts. The ancient Egyptian king lists, compiled and put together by the Greek priest Manetho, indicated that the first pharaoh ruled somewhere around 3000 BC. To the Egyptians, history went back in a continual long line, right back to a remote past beyond the first pharaoh, whose name was Menes or Nama, who unified Egypt, to a remote time of spirit kings. But the question which Petrie confronted was who was in Egypt before dynastic Egypt, pharaonic Egypt, began in about 3100 BC. He was the man who identified the first pre-dynastic farming cultures in Egypt. He did so at a town called Nagada in Upper Egypt. And there, in the desert, and remember, the land of the living is the valley and the land of the dead is the desert to the west, where sun sets. He uncovered huge cemeteries. In 1894 alone, he uncovered 2,000 simple graves. Now, please do not think of royal tombs adorned with gold. Forget Tutankhamun, Ramesses II, Akhenaten, and all those folk. Think of shallow pits, each containing a skeleton and decorated clay pots, dating to the time before recorded Egyptian history. But how old were these skeletons? How could you tell which was earlier than which? And here Petrie showed his genius, educated himself and schooled himself on small objects, and he took the jars found in these tombs, and he studied them minutely. And he looked at things like the shape of the handles. And he argued that these handles had developed. And he drew up a scheme of burials with pots in them, groups, where one group would have a lot with finely shaped handles or certain painted designs. Others would have a simple pot with just a squiggle representing the handle painted on it. And there was a sequence between them. He developed an artificial sequence which showed the evolution from the one to the other, with the intermediate steps using pottery styles, grouping the burials. And he developed an elaborate system of what he called sequence dating. This was an arbitrary sequence which started with sequence date 30 and went back into the past, where you had groupings. And these were relatively earlier or later than each other. He had no idea how old they were in years, but he studied each group as a separate unit, took the pots in them and put them in order using the style. This was a revolutionary development because it's based on the assumption that when you have everybody, say, wearing blue sweaters, that's the time of maximum popularity. And he used this fashion, the changing fashions, as the way to order these. And history has shown that basically he was right, and he produced the first sequence of Egyptian culture before the pharaohs. He couldn't date it. He could give it order, but he couldn't date it. And the years that followed, other researches showed that, in fact, there were a set of pre-dynastic kingdoms which were the founders of ancient Egypt. His first date was a dated royal burial of 3000 BC, and he worked back from there. And this method, which he called sequence dating, which he published in 1898, was the pioneer of extremely sophisticated artifact ordering schemes which are used all over the world to this day. Again, he was a founder of modern archaeological methods. Petrie was an exhausting man. He kept up an exhausting pace. The sequence dating was just part of what he did. He excavated a site and published it each year, continuing to work on and off in Egypt until 1926. At that point, increasingly strict regulations regarding the export of antiquities, and remember how he supported excavations by selling artifacts, as a result of the Tutankhamun find, the Egyptians tightened this up. It was an emerging tide of nationalism. He moved to Palestine and worked where he'd started in 1890 on city mounds and Bronze Age states. But by then, however, he changed the Egyptology from an amateur pastime into a fledgling science and trained talented successors. His influence on archaeology and ancient civilizations was enormous. And among those he influenced was Arthur Evans, who discovered the Minoan civilization of Crete, which we describe in Lecture 15.